hello and welcome to the Investors Chronicle Companies and Markets Show. I am John Heumann, editor of the Investors Chronicle, joined today by Phil Oakley. How are you doing, Phil?
I'm good, thank you.
Excellent. Been a busy week, hasn't it? Lots of news.
Lots going on, yeah.
Lots going on. And some of that you covered in your Alpha report this week. Three separate companies covered in your magazine write-up.
That's bank holiday related, that.
Bank holiday related, yeah. Mm-hmm. It's, yeah, affected all of us, including our magazine production schedule. The cover feature this week is the second part of our AIM100 series. So too many companies there to talk about individually on this podcast. But there is one company in the AIM100 that perhaps we should start with. Before we move on to companies like Reckitt and Domino's, who are in the news this week, which is Purple Bricks, which we've written about in the news section, and you've also put your two pennies worth in there as well. Not a good week for Purple Bricks, but not a surprise either.
No, definitely not a surprise. I think what's been announced this week is not going to surprise a lot of people. This is a classic case of a company trying to run before it can walk. You look at Purple Bricks, and actually, you think this is actually quite a nice idea, and I think the company deserves a lot of credit because it has reinforced and strengthened the view that the traditional estate agent model of selling houses to consumers it's too expensive
because it's commission based.
Because it's percentage of value commission based.
Yeah.
It's been ripe. That traditional estate agency pricing model, charging model, has been ripe for attack for a long time.
So it goes back to a lot of the things we've been saying about other types of companies that are in, you know, have had these, you know, been in market positions where they have had the ability to set their own price and ripe for disruption.
Yep.
Like, for example, funerals, where we've obviously seen problems with Dignity.
Yeah.
I guess the basis of your thesis of their problems is that that model also leaves itself somewhat open to the problems it's now suffering, which is that if you're charging a flat fee and don't sell the property, the consumer is no better off.
Yeah, and I think in a slowing housing market, that is not going to endear yourself to getting more customers to come and use you.
Is that what's actually happening though here?
Not yet. But I think, you know, we were talking before we came on that housing market stats are actually not too bad recently. But the market has gone a lot softer, and I think that the traditional agents have woken up to the threat of internet estate agencies and Purple Bricks in particular. And there's lots of evidence that they are cutting their prices. You can haggle now and get quite close to the sort of £1,000 flat fee that that Purple Bricks charges. And the big problem is that traditional agent, if you don't sell, you don't get paid. Purple Bricks, you get paid whether you sell or not. And I think there's a lot of potential for customers using Purple Bricks or any other company that adopts this internet selling flat fee business, whether you pay whether you sell or you don't, to get a bit hacked off with it. And, you know, if you think the market's soft and houses are staying on the market a lot longer and you can haggle a good deal with an estate agent, then that's probably worthwhile doing. You know, if you don't sell, you don't pay. But this is not really the issue that's hurting Purple Bricks at the moment. I think eventually it will. The UK business actually is doing all right for them. They are making a small profit. The problem with Purple Bricks is that it hasn't allowed time to make significant profits in the UK to get real confidence that this is a sustainable and meaningfully profitable business before taking it somewhere else. It's taken it to Australia and America, and also Canada, where it's doing okay. But in America and Australia in particular, it's not working for them. You need a lot of money to market this business to people to go. You know, you look at the adverts that you've seen in the UK, you're going into much bigger countries, much bigger markets, and therefore the cost of actually building up a business from scratch is huge. And it takes a long time before you can make a profit. And whilst you're trying to make a profit, you're burning through shed loads of cash.
Well, I guess, why have they done that, though? I guess maybe I mean, I'm guessing here, maybe their concern was that if they don't make that move themselves, someone would just replicate their model in those markets and beat them to it.
That's possible. But I think, you know, I'll go back to my previous point, is that you don't know if it works. You don't know if this model flies through different states of the world. You know that you can make a small amount of profit in markets like the UK, but you're going into completely different markets, and you don't really know whether you can take what you've been doing in the UK and make it work somewhere else. And this is what they're finding. And, you know, they're closing down their Australian business. They're scaling back the American business, which I think will probably lead to them getting out of it anyway, because, you know, if you're going to scale back, you're just not going to build that brand awareness.
I mean, this is something I always worry about with companies trying to conquer the US. This isn't one, it's not one country in some respects. It's 50 different states, which are all very different markets in a very large sort of federal entity.
Yeah.
It's not one country.
Yeah, but yeah, it isn't. But, you know, I see the logic of trying to make this work in America. Because if we think our state agency fees are high here, they are absolutely horrendous over there.
Yeah, I've always wondered why state agents were so rich actually here, but in America, I mean, millionaires.
But, you know, you look at this company now, and you know that it's making big losses in America, big losses in Australia. It's got just over 60 million quid's worth of cash left. You know, you do start asking questions whether they can, you know, the cost of closing this down or absorbing continued losses in America, that, you know, they're going to run out, you know, are they going to run out of cash?
It's still quite a big company, isn't it? I mean,
you know,
300 odd million.
375 million, I think, when I wrote this at the beginning of the week. You know, they have tapped, I think from memory, they tapped shareholders for a bit of money a year or so ago. I think the cash burn looks pretty significant here.
And overall loss-making?
Overall, significantly loss-making because of what's been going on in Australia and America.
Hey, is this one of those, you know, companies that is a reflection of the idea that actually you can bring companies to market based on an idea,
yeah,
and then see what happens?
Yeah, yeah, which is
kind of what we're seeing, you know, with the kind of whole unicorn phenomenon.
And I don't like this, do we? Right, you know,
I just feel like I'm a cynic.
No, I agree. You know, this is a, you know, this is almost experimental in lots of ways. And, you know, you look back and you look at the prices. And I think I mentioned this in my column last week in the magazine, you know, when I talked about valuations in general. And you can see it with the likes of Uber and Lyft, how, you know, people are prepared to value a new idea or concept or disruptor, which is what these companies are, and price this for success very quickly without any evidence whatsoever that the profits are going to come back.
Yeah, indeed. So Uber, I don't think it's yet hit the market, but the plans are in motion.
Yeah,
and the valuation is in the sort of multiple tens of billions.
I think we're talking 86 billion.
86 billion. And as far as I understand it, within their prospectus or whatever they issue out there, there is no path to profit.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they're quite upfront about it and say, look, we don't know if we can ever make a profit here.
I just don't know why you would buy that.
I think it's a sign of lots of things which aren't very good. You know, it's a sign of perhaps stock market excess in general,
cheap money,
greed. You know, people cashing out, taking the fees, allowing the selling shareholders to just cash out at a very high price based on hope, and you know, you can't feel sorry for individual investors. The risks are there. You know, you buy this, you buy this with your eyes wide open. If you get burned, you get burned.
Mm.
And, you know, not many people are going to feel sorry for you.
You mean as a private investor or as an institution that's backing these things?
Both. You know, the facts are there in front of you. These companies aren't making any money. You buy this and you're being sold it on the hope that it's going to be transformed. You know, it's going to be like an Amazon. You know, it's going to be like an Amazon or a Google, which truly does succeed and revolutionise the markets that they're in, they're story stocks. You know, if you look a bit more closely at things like the taxi market, taxi markets are horrible market.
Indeed, I often have a chat with a taxi driver on the way home from an evening out with the team, and it's a tricky business.
Yeah, it's a really tricky business.
You know, small local cab firms.
Yeah.
Uber's not one of those. They're not out in the sticks where I live, but these taxi firms struggle to get drivers. They struggle to have
the drivers are on strike, aren't they?
Uber drivers, but local taxi drivers, they just struggle to get enough of them. There's competing firms. It's a tough business.
A real bun fight. And then, you know, you go back to the estate agency business. It's something I know a little bit about.
Again, a bum fight, though, really.
Yeah, it's, you're scrapping for business. And when it turns down, it's, you know, you get several agents who will scrap. Because if they're not selling, they're not making any money. You know, my in-laws ran an estate agent for 30 years. And I can tell you that when they wanted to sell it, no one wanted to buy it.
Mm. And the same actually happened. I know some people who were small local travel agents in the years gone by, which was a kind of nice business for many people to be in. That died.
Yeah,
retire. Can't sell the business.
Yeah, you know, you can say, look, you know, we've not got the overheads with all these chains of high street offices, and we've got an internet cost base. But the fundamental selling model is not quite the same. But you know, you need transactions as a traditional state. And going back to Purple Bricks is trying to say, no, we don't need transactions. We just need listings. And I think eventually, you know, we've seen companies like eMove, I think, close down.
They did indeed, yeah.
Yeah, they can't make it work. Probably
they had a slightly different model.
Yeah, but probably also because Purple Bricks got in front of them. And it's not, you know, it's not easy. But the fundamental business of a state agency is a low valuation business. This is not something that you put a high multiple on.
Let's talk about low valuation businesses. Moving on from estate agency, I think we've decided estate agency, horrible business to be in. Purple Bricks may have a different approach.
Nice idea. Yeah.
Difficult market.
But it's not working.
I mean, let's look at someone more traditional, Countrywide, not great.
Yeah. Foxtons.
Not great.
Yeah.
Another low margin business is automotive retailers.
Yeah.
And Vertu Motors had some results this week, and I know you've got some views on automotive retailers because that's another big volume, low margin type of game, and really difficult.
Difficult, but they're actually doing all right.
Yeah, I do struggle to understand how they're managing that because you know the car market has been dreadful.
It is dreadful, and that's the headlines that you get in your newspapers every few weeks or every month when the Society for Motor Manufacturers and Traders gives their monthly view of the car market and all the statistics. But car dealers have always made the bulk of their money from selling used cars and from servicing, after sales, spare parts, repairs. That is where the big source of their profits are coming from. And if you look at most of the motor retailers, this is what's happening. They're making the used market is holding up a lot better than the new market, and they're making a lot of money on servicing, which is one of the main reasons I would never take my car to a main dealer to have it serviced. I've been looking at Vertu Motors yesterday and seeing them say that they make a 75% gross profit margin on servicing. I know I've done the right thing.
Where do you go instead? I'd like to know. I use a
local independent Volkswagen servicing, and they charge a fraction of the price of the main dealer. They're all linked up. They do digital servicing. Everything that you can get done there. They get a better job. It's a better service. And, you know, I can see why, you know, lots of people love the convenience of dutifully returning to the main dealer. And I think Vertu gave some figures, actually, saying about 58% of new car buyers returned and bought servicing and servicing plans.
Yeah, it's interesting. When I bought
the used car was about 43%.
Yeah, I don't know why you take a used car to a main dealer. I mean, I bought a new car many, many years ago, which I no longer have. I think we had it for about 12 years.
Yeah.
So, you know, wasn't a bad purchase, really. Yeah. But for the first three, when it was under guarantee, go back to the dealer. The moment that stops, shop around.
And that mindset still prevails. But also a lot of cars on PCP. You have to get your car pretty much serviced through the main dealer. So the boom in PCP has actually been very good for the servicing departments of these franchised car dealerships.
Mm.
And I think, you know, despite my views, you know, I realise that on many things, as with this, I'm at odds of what lots of people do. I think that that's a decent stream of income that's going to hang around for quite a few years for these companies and will keep their profits reasonably good, I would say.
But then why bother selling cars?
Well, this is a big debate. You know, one of the interesting things about, you know, you've got a couple of things going on here. You've got the trend for lots of things being sold over the internet. So why don't people buy cars over the internet? And also you have, and this is more of a long-term thing, electric vehicles, which require a lot less servicing. And because there's no oil to change, fewer moving parts. And that's going to become an issue one day for these kind of businesses.
We've got a big feature coming up, actually, in the next couple of weeks, being written by one of our star writers, Alex Genois. It's called Carmageddon.
Yeah.
This market is... I mean, we talked about disruption in estate agency. The car market is going through an existential change.
Yeah, I mean... I mean, we're not seeing any evidence of it yet. I mean, the car...
That's partly because EV has been slow to come through, yeah. but it's there. It's looming over the horizon.
In terms of distribution, you know, in terms of selling, you know, the car manufacturers, certainly in this country, pretty much rely on, you know, franchise motor dealers to sell their stuff. People say, you know, you've got the local Volkswagen dealership. It isn't Volkswagen that you're dealing with. You're, you know, dealing with John Smith's trading as... Essex Volkswagen.
Yeah, and it's quite a fragmented market still. So, as far as I understand it, a lot of these motor chains, whether it be Vertu or you know, Pendragon or whoever it is, are kind of still in consolidation.
And that's going to continue. And I think you're going to get even more. I think you're going to get brand consolidation as well. I mean, you know, one of the problems that the likes of the Vertu and so on are dealing with is that their cost base is going up. There are shortages of mechanics, which is pushing up wage costs. You've got business rates going up. You've got things like tooling costs going up because cars become more sophisticated, more complicated. And I think what you're going to see over the next few years is a consolidation of different brands on the same dealership site. Mm. You're beginning to see it already. You know, so instead of having, you know, just one brand at one location, they may sell two or three different brands.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I'm not sure how they win out of that, but it might stop them from losing in that it allows them to use their space and their property portfolio more efficiently.
Well, drivers do have, something of a sort of brand loyalty when it comes to automotive brands themselves.
Yeah.
I know you're a VW stroke Audi guy.
Shh, shh.
I'm a Kia guy. But no, there is some brand loyalty there, so that kind of does make sense. Especially if, you know, people become a little bit, you know, because not all companies have equal EV ranges, you know, no. So people are starting to be a bit more circumspect in their buying.
And I also think that, you know, the cars are not the easiest things to sell over the internet. People want to test drive them. There's often financing involved and that kind of thing. But it's always puzzled me why we have this dealer network thing. And, you know, why would you not try and just cut out the middleman and actually start selling direct to consumers like Nike does or Adidas does?
It's the old model.
Yeah.
It's just the way it's always been done.
Yeah.
And always right for disruption. So
honestly, you know, we're talking quite bearishly here long term, but I actually think short term, these companies are actually in not bad shape.
And the shares are quite cheap. I mean, looking at that Vertu graph, they've come off quite substantially.
Come off a lot. I mean, you know, a lot of bad news is priced into these companies. I mean, I think there's a rocky road ahead. We've got new emissions coming in this year, which led to a lot of delays of new models. But I think their bread and butter in terms of their profits, in terms of used and servicing, looks all right.
I mean, let's stick with the car theme. going back, sort of tying this back into what we talked about in terms of the unicorns, you know, Uber and Lyft,
yeah.
which has IPO'd and has been a bit of a damp squib.
Yeah.
Aren't they bets on the fact that people aren't going to buy cars in future? That actually people will just, you know, use a car when they need it.
Hire it
from one of these firms or get a driver for a very short journey they need to do.
Yeah, and it's why the likes of Google and Dyson are looking at, you know, autonomous vehicles as well. Driverless cars. I should have said rather than that, you know, flowery language.
Autonomous vehicles.
Driverless cars. Let's stick with that.
I did read something the other day from an expert, although of course we don't listen to them very much anymore. That the driverless car technology is a very, very long way away.
Yeah, I think so.
You know, there are many interim steps before we get there.
But
the whole model of car ownership could change as well.
I think if you look at, you know, what's happening in terms of urban congestion, it's not really fun driving anymore. You know, owning a car is that it just burns a hole in your wallet. And I think that in big cities, big towns, you can see a shift. But whether anyone can make any money out of that is another matter.
Indeed. I had a small argument with my wife recently, not over the washing up, but over car ownership. She loves cars. Yeah. She loves driving.
Yeah.
And she said, but people need cars to get around. People need, you know, to get from A to B. But we live out in the sticks. You do kind of need a car.
You do.
And she refused to believe. My point was that most people live in kind of conurbations now. And actually, there is an appetite for a different ownership model. So, yeah.
I look up
stats and I was right.
And what,
which is always nice.
What it means for investors, I'm not so sure. Because, you know, Lyft is nowhere near making a profit. Its turnover actually doubled. It put out its results, I think, yesterday.
But then, you know, you can take
its losses went up.
But then you can take that back to, like, the early days of Amazon and say no one was really sure that this kind of model would be the future, and it kind of was. But I do think Amazon is a special company.
I think now that Amazon has got the cloud computing business, it has changed the picture of that business.
It's like their float, isn't it? It's like their
it's
like their Buffett float.
Oh yeah, it is literally transforming the financial performance of that business. It gives them a lot of firepower.
Yeah, I mean, talking of Buffett, you've had a little insight into Buffett's latest dealings this week. You're not impressed.
I mean,
a bit of context. Warren Buffett he's been in the news quite a lot recently. It was the Berkshire Hathaway annual shareholders meeting, which is always a bit of a jamboree. There was a big interview in the Financial Times.
Yeah,
which in fact one of our former editors conducted, Oliver Ralph, and actually he said something like, "Oh, I'm looking at businesses in the UK," which I thought was kind of interesting. Which ones, Warren?
Yeah,
there's a big petroleum deal which somehow or other is linked to Warren Buffett. Talk us through this.
Yeah, so there's an American company called Occidental Petroleum that is trying to buy a company, I think it's called
Anadarko,
and it's got into a bit of a bidding war with Chevron. And Warren Buffett has come along and said, "Look, this is going to cost about $38 billion. I can give you $10 billion towards this, and in return, I want you to give me a very nice heads I win, tails you lose deal."
Sounds like a classic Buffett deal.
Yeah, this is a classic Buffett deal. Which he did with General Electric, Bank of America, and Goldman Sachs. And he gets preference shares, so he gets paid before the shareholders do. And so £10 billion worth of preference shares with an 8% interest rate, which is very nice. And then also has options or warrants over around 80 million Occidental shares at a price of about $62.50, which is about, I think when I wrote, I don't know what the share price is now, but when I was writing this on Tuesday, it was 58. So not much more than the current share price. And if the share price goes down, Warren's not really bothered because he's still going to collect his $800 million of preference dividend. But this really does, in my opinion, represent a horrendous deal for Occidental shareholders. And it's very difficult, and I mention it, that, you know, this is a company with a market capitalization of about $44 billion. It has borrowings of about $7 billion, billion dollars, and it's churning out $3 billion of free cash flow.
Why are they taking Buffett's cash then?
I don't know. I don't know. I mean, I think, you know, there are people who are concerned that this is a risky deal. But it's very difficult not to think that this is a company that could have raised money cheaper than this on the markets. If we look where interest rates are in America, you know, investment grade corporate bonds are yielding what, about 3.5?
Well, I mean, you know, you look at WeWork, going back to the unicorn thing. They raised, I think it was a $500 million bond that they were looking for. I think they got 7 in the end. Yeah. It was like 7 or 8%.
But the problem with the preference share, of course, is that it's not tax deductible. You know, because you're paying it out of after-tax profits, whereas if you pay interest on borrowings, you lower your pre-tax profits and you lower your tax bill. So this is a very expensive way to raise money. And then the potential dilution to existing Occidental shareholders just makes it look even more expensive. It's a great, you know, it's an okay deal for Berkshire because of the rate of return, and there's not a lot of downside unless Occidental goes bust, which it probably won't. But actually, what does this do for Berkshire? Not a lot. You know, you're looking at a company that made nearly $25 billion of operating profit last year. Adding another $800 million of preference dividend stream isn't really going to move the dial at Berkshire that much. And it also, you know, this is, you know, a lot of Buffett fans lauding this, but this is not the kind of deal that you and I can do.
Well, that's true of many of the deals Buffett has done in the past, including Tesco, interestingly, yeah. which a lot of people, when Tesco was on its knees and he bought into it, everyone, but Buffett's backing Tesco. He backed it in a way which massively protected him.
Yeah, I mean, you know, to be fair, you know, just to sort of add some balance to this, I mean, this is one of the reasons why you would own stock of Berkshire Hathaway, because you've got somebody like him who is very influential. The company has a lot of cash and he can do these little niche deals. Mm. But it's not, you know, this is not going to move the dial of a $500 billion market capitalization company.
I do wonder what he's going to buy in the UK, going back to Mr. Ralph's interview.
I suggested he might have a look at Reckitt's.
Yeah, indeed. That's the main subject of your column this week. Reckitt Bank is best known, I guess, for Sillitt Bang.
Well, amongst other things, you know.
Sillitt Bang. It's the Sillitt Bang company.
Things like Nurofen.
I covered it long enough ago that Sillitt Bang was the main action.
I was warned off that, told it absolutely disintegrates your taps, apparently.
But Reckitt Bank here, so I guess, falls into that category of company that has come to be known as a bond proxy.
Well, if you look at, you know, Buffett's got form here. You know, he's owned businesses like Gillette, Procter & Gamble. They own Duracell batteries now, I think, is wholly owned by Berkshire.
Kraft was something he had a big stake in.
He was part of the plan to buy Unilever.
Yeah.
So this is a kind of business that, you know, market cap, what, $40 billion, roughly?
It's a big company.
Big company, but he wants what he refers to as an elephant.
He needs an elephant.
Yeah.
Berkshire's so big, that's what they need.
Yeah. This is a company that has got a few issues. You know, there's a few sort of legal and regulatory issues going on in the background with things in South Korea.
That's still going on.
Yeah, and then stuff with Indivior, of course. Which
are they still involved in that?
There's a provision on the balance sheet for $400 million to cover that.
That's pretty chunky.
It might not be big enough. Some people think.
Yeah,
but the main problem this company's got is actually getting these portfolio of brands and churning out consistently good sales growth from them. It's very, very patchy. And, you know, one of the worries I would have about a business like this is that, you know, we talked a few weeks ago about the sort of Amazon and the discounter effect of the Aldis and Lidls. And this is going on in not just groceries, but, you know, in terms of consumer brands as well. And the growth of private label in terms of the scale of it, but also the quality of it is getting better and better. And this, I think, is an issue. It's not hitting home at Reckitt's yet, but it's a kind of thing where you look at, you know, you just put yourself in the, you know, you're in your week doing your weekly shop, and you look at things that you'll put in your basket, like finished dishwasher tablets, Dettol spray, Nurofen. These are the things that can be substituted by very effective, almost equally effective private label substitute products for a fraction of the price. And, you know, we're living in a world now where I think some consumer brands are actually quite vulnerable. And I think we're at the beginning, potentially, of a story where this could develop over the next decade.
I mean, something like a dishwasher tablet is not something that, you know, it's not like a sort of purchase, a keeping up with the Jones type purchase. No. It's not something that you boast to the world about. You know, certain sort of food brands, personal care brands, they define you in some way. And a dishwasher tablet does not.
No, nor does an ibuprofen tablet. Or, you know, or something that you spray your kitchen surfaces with.
Yeah, I tend to agree. Although brands like Dettol, I mean, they have a long legacy. You know, people are quite, there is this sort of inertia and loyalty that exists without a doubt.
No, they have that security feeling that the brand, that a long established brand gives.
Mm.
But you know, Reckitt's itself, you know, it has a cough, cold, and flu treatment mainly in America called Mucinex.
Sounds lovely.
Yeah, and they, you know, they are saying there, look, that private label competition is taking a bite out of it.
I can believe that. I mean, I earlier this year had possibly the worst flu I've had in as long as I can remember. And yeah, I walked in Superdrug, and you know, the price of the Strepsils versus the own label stuff for the same ingredients.
Yeah, yeah. Because
you know, despite being dead on my feet, I was still like, what's the active ingredient? And it's like, this is half the price, and it's got more drugs in it.
Yeah,
this is great.
But you see, these things can persist for a long time. You know, you see trends or situations. You know, you can see them, or maybe think you see them, that they can persist for years, and then something will happen. Probably a recession, when people have to become a bit more value focused, and they'll think, hold on a minute, I'm not paying that for those tablets, I'm going to stick some of these in instead. They'll do just the same job. There are bits of the business which I think are relatively defensive, and the baby food business, which they paid a hell of a lot of money for, that's the kind of business that is pretty quite defensive. You know, there are strict standards, the barriers to entry of entering that market are pretty high, and when people are dealing with their children, they want the confidence of a very strong brand. And I think strategically, I can see why Reckitt's bought that, and I think it is quite defensive. My concern about it is whether it can grow enough.
Hmm.
You're already seeing that in places like China, the decline in the birth rate is coming through. In America, it's doing a little bit better, but it's been very patchy. But I think there's something with this company that makes me think that something could happen with it.
Okay, so basically the share price, I mean, looking at that chart, it had a good run from 2015, but it's been very weak for the last couple of years.
Yeah, and it's on a cheap rating relative to its peers.
It's relative to other, what you might have once called bond proxies, yeah, of which you might have considered this company a bond proxy
and it's
at
still,
one point.
Still, you know, this is a business that's making, you know, mid-20s operating profit margin. Good cash flow.
So this is a special situation, potentially.
Well, and the company is actually helping things along here. It's got a project going where the health business and the hygiene business are actually pretty much being run as autonomous separate businesses, which makes one of them sometime in the future easier to spin off.
And there's a lot of that stuff going on in this particular market. We've seen deals between
Pfizer and Glaxo.
So there's lots of stuff going on.
I think, you know, I'm not saying that all is well with Reckitt, but I think there's something in here in terms of the market that it's in the structure of the company, the price of the shares, that makes me think something could happen with this. It would not surprise me.
Let's talk about another company that apparently used to sell something that everybody wanted and couldn't get enough of, but we're seeing some real trouble here. Domino's, we've covered it quite a lot on this podcast.
Yeah.
They've warned this week that their overseas businesses are not doing quite what they expected them to do, but I think your concerns lie deeper than that.
Yeah, I mean, the overseas businesses have, you know, never really had the potential to make huge amounts of money, in my opinion. They have been the cream on the cake, shall we say, or the extra cheese on the topping.
I thought they were. I always thought of those international forays as we're trying to build something that once the UK is mature will give us something else.
Yeah, there's that. But if you actually look at apart from the sort of German joint venture that they've got, they're in places like Iceland, Norway, Sweden, Switzerland, which aren't really massive markets.
No.
And it's difficult to see how that would transform the company. My concern over the last 2 years has been what's been going on in the UK.
And this is mainly around the franchisees.
Yeah, probably. And the franchisees are getting hacked off here because obviously Domino's needs to grow the number of pizzas. So Domino's is reliant on its franchisees to open up more stores, sell more pizza. Domino's makes the bulk of its profits from selling pizza ingredients to its franchisees, not from the royalties, percentage of sales of total turnover that the franchisees make from selling pizzas. And there's been bubbling amount of discontent on things like, I know it sounds very sort of specialist, but like the cheese price. So some franchisees and big franchisees, and the power of the franchisees shouldn't be underestimated. There are a very small amount of franchisees that are responsible for a large chunk of the actual business. And I think there's been a view that Domino's is very quick to pass on ingredient cost inflation, but not quick to give it back. But there's a more serious issue going on, in my opinion, and this is the strategy of opening more stores by what they call splitting territories. So, for example, if you live in a town where there perhaps was two Domino's pizzas, there's now three.
Yeah.
And the risk with this, and we've seen this in the restaurant business with something like Restaurant Group, is that once you start over-expanding, that new third restaurant starts taking sales from the first two.
Now, I guess we've kind of known that this was a risk for a while.
Yeah.
And it's been a kind of key sort of bear thesis of yours. We're now seeing signs that is having an impact.
And the thing is the company is being quite evasive, in my view, about actually the extent of what people call cannibalization of sales is going on, because it is going on. And they present their like-for-likes excluding the effect of splitting, rather than actually giving. So we don't know the effect of the splits.
Does that mean we don't really know their like-for-likes?
You can work them out when you get to the half-year reports, when they give a bridge,
right?
Like a sales bridge. You can see that they do give it, but in like in a quarterly report like they're given this week, they don't give it. You have to wait for the half year and the full year result, and you can see that it is taking sales. It is cannibalizing sales, and it also is affecting the profitability of the new store and the existing store. There was something in a presentation a year or so ago which shows that the initial splits have survived, but the later split territories are finding it harder.
Mm.
Now, if you're a franchisee and Mr. Domino's is asking you to open more stores, you start thinking, I don't like this. And I'm thinking, I'm not going to open more stores unless I can get a good return on my investment. It's £300,000 to open it. Is the capital required you need to sink into a new Domino's franchise. And whilst, you know, Domino's has put the figures out in terms of EBITDA, that the returns on the franchisees' sort of established stores are still pretty good, actually. In terms of the new ones, particularly if you're in a split territory, it's by no means certain that the returns going forward are going to be as good. So what we've got now is a standoff. We've got standoffs, and the franchisees are saying, I don't want to open stores. Now, last year we had nearly 60 new stores opened. This year, so far, we've had 4. There's another 3 about to open up. And then if you actually look at the plans, the total openings are actually with firm sort of shovels in the ground, shall we say, is about 15.
It's quite low for a group as big as this.
15 when on a base of sort of 1,100.
Yes, it's tiny.
Now, this is a big source of forecast risk, in that if people are basing their forecasts on 60 a year opening up in the UK, and we're only doing 15, and that this splitting of territories is changing the economics of new stores, this is a big problem.
Yeah. Yeah, indeed. And that is the final word on Domino's. We've actually got them on sale at the magazine, have done for quite some time, and you don't sound too bullish here either.
I think it's actually, on a standalone basis, has been a very, very good business.
Yeah, all good things come to an end.
And I think, you know, I'll put my hands up and say, you know, perhaps 2 years ago, I never saw this as an issue. But you can only look at what you can see, and what you see is, you know, there's grounds to worry here.
Indeed. There's plenty more in the magazine this week. Let me just talk you through some of the highlights. John Barron has updated his investment trust portfolios, looking at the idea of selling in May and concluding that it's best to stay invested. Alex Newman is looking at the bank's first quarter updates, seeing the trends there, looking like actually the Asian-focused banks are doing much better than the UK-focused banks. Algie's Peter Lynch-inspired growth stock screen is updated this week. He's commenting there really on a sort of worrying inconsistency, which is at odds with the Peter Lynch approach of actually finding consistency. A few results this week. It hasn't got busy yet, thank goodness. And plenty more in the news section that we haven't covered, including some numbers from ITV, which are slightly worrying, and an update on Vodafone, and in particular, their deal in Germany. Thank you all for listening. Pick up the magazine in all good newsagents, the AIM 100 Part 2. Continuing our countdown of the biggest companies on the junior market, it's numbers 50 to 1. Pick it up in all good newsagents, £4.90, and we'll be back again next week. Thank you very much.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.